You know, when I started these homelessness marathons, I used to think that my job here was to convince everybody that homelessness was a bad thing and wake everybody up to this emergency, and it is an emergency for people on the streets. But now that I'm entering my fourth homelessness marathon, my attitude has changed, because the good news about the broadcast, the one thing I've learned over the years, is that Americans really do care. Had so much help, so many volunteers for this marathon, I couldn't even begin to tell you all the good things that have happened just in preparing for it, all the people who put in their effort, and they put that effort in because they care. So I don't look at this anymore as a chance to try and convince the people of America that homelessness is something that needs to be dealt with. No matter how silent our leaders may be about it, I know that the people of this country really do care. And what I'm hoping to do with this marathon is to introduce you to some people who you may never have had a chance to speak to, hear their stories, learn more about the issue. And I think, above all, create a sense, if I can, in whatever way I can, that this is something we don't have to just live with. Lauren, you're in a very different situation, as I understand it. You've never been homeless. You're not actually a homeless person now. But as I understand it, you may be homeless as of tomorrow. Is that correct?
Yeah.
You've lost your housing?
I have Section 8, and my landlord decided to raise the rent in September to $950, which they approved, and now he wants to go as high as $1,500 because the cost of living in East Boston says he can do so.
So now, let's back up, because a lot of people don't even know what we're talking about here, and we want to get the details. Section 8, that means you have these famous vouchers that they give to people?
I wasn't officially homeless. I was in a coma for 2.5 months, and I did 2.5 years of rehab at Spalding.
How did that happen to you?
I have a head injury. I got hit by a drunk driver on a bike.
That's terrible.
So I technically have been legally emancipated and on my own since the age of 16, have also come from a very dysfunctional family as far as dysfunctional towards sexual abuse towards me. As far as carrying grades and doing everything that my family expected me to, I think I did my part in trying to keep my parents very happy with that. I'm also a college student right now, and I'm a shift supervisor at CVS, but on the verge of becoming homeless as of tomorrow. I go to court, and hopefully I'll get an extension, but right now nobody wants Section 8 because they're not paying as high as the landlords want to see the dollar signs coming in a lot higher than what Section 8 can pay.
I want to explain to people who are listening. We have been told that instead of building housing, the solution, I mean, this is a political point of view that's out there, that the solution to housing is not to build more public housing, which is much criticized by the conservatives. The solution is to create a voucher system. Why? With these vouchers, landlords will have an incentive to create new housing. They'll get these vouchers. It's good as gold to them, and they'll have that money from the government, and they'll want to rent to homeless people. But what you're saying is, Lauren, you've got one of these vouchers, and it isn't working for you.
I'm running out of time, actually, before my voucher is taken away from me. They only allow so long for you to have time to find another apartment, and hopefully I'll get another extension tomorrow. If not, I'm not sure what I'm going to do.
But you're not finding that these vouchers are the greatest thing in the world as far as the landlords are concerned?
No, because finding an apartment, too, that will accept that is usually not the best place to live either. They're run down. They're not kept up. Landlords don't want to pay to get things repaired. You have to have an inspection before you move in, and it has to abide by the laws of the Section 8, regulations as far as, you know, fire exits and fire extinguishers and things like that. And a lot of landlords, you know, leave it up to the tenants to add these things in their apartment.
Now, if I understand you correctly, though, your landlord raised the rent. You went to whoever the agency is, which says they'll cover it.
They
accepted the raise, and now he's raising it more, and it's gotten too expensive for the voucher program.
Exactly.
Well, the voucher people, who do you work with? The Department of Social Services? Is it who gives you that voucher?
Massachusetts Department of Housing in Boston.
And those people, you go to them, and do they say to you, look, you've got a voucher, that means the government guarantees you housing, so it doesn't matter, we'll find a place for you? Is that what they say to you?
Well, pretty much it's left up for me to look for apartments in papers, newspapers, and to call around. Other than that, my advocate from the agency pretty much just tallies my income when it goes up and down and does my annual inspections and keeps my voucher stable for me. As far as finding a place for me to live, they don't get involved with that at all. They do have a resource room where you can use the computer and newspapers and things like that, and I have been beneficial to me as far as information, but I haven't gotten any calls back on wanting to look into my voucher for me becoming a tenant for them. I've been doing this for 2 months now, and I'm not having any luck.
At the mic I have here in Cambridge, Massachusetts, someone who wants to speak. Welcome to the Homelessness Marathon. Can you hear me at the mic?
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, what's your name?
Hi, my name is Catherine Rhodes. I'm housing coordinator for People to End Homelessness. We're a group of homeless, former homeless people who get together and we advocate for ourselves. And I heard the young woman talking about the Section 8 vouchers.
Yes.
And how they work. People don't realize that you get a Section 8 voucher from HUD, which is the Housing and Urban Development. And they basically give you the voucher and say, go out and find a place. But what they don't tell you is that they pay for the 40th percentile, which is not the average rent. So you go out there and you're already in the hole because they're not paying for what the average rent is. They're paying for the 40th percentile. I know I come from Providence, Rhode Island, and I have families and individuals calling me all the time looking for places. And they're already out in the hole because HUD is not willing to pay to the 15th percentile. So that's the number one thing. Also, the pay rates are very low for communities. I know in our community, the average rent is $700 a month with nothing included. And the voucher only pays $500. So you're at a hole to begin with. And I think the whole HUD needs to go back and look at the ironing board on these things because vouchers are not working. They've gotten out of the business of producing housing, and that has been the effects are very hard on our area of the country where most of the people are getting vouchers, which are useless. We have a 2% vacancy rate in Providence. I know Boston is very low also. Supply and demand, the market goes with the higher rents, and people just will not rent because they're looking for the extra $200, $300 that they can get.
Yeah.
And so recently we had a protest on HUD, and we think they need to go back to the drawing board on this because it's not working. People are waiting 5 years. They get a certificate. They have 120 days to look for a place. And if they don't find a place, their voucher's gone, and they go to the bottom of the list. Now, that's not fair. I mean, it's just not fair.
Mm-hmm.
And so they really need to look at that. And so I just wanted to put my 2 cents
well,
in.
Well, thank you. Hang on a second.
That.
Lauren, I see you nodding your head. This corresponds to your experience?
Oh, yeah, I totally agree with everything she says. I just came from a meeting last week about the 40 percentile.
Mm-hmm.
They were telling me, because I've been in the same apartment for 4 years. I've never had to move. And I'm a tenant that once I get somewhere, I'll stay.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, only because I've known what's, you know, how the
being thrown out as a bad tenant. The guy just wants more money,
exactly.
And the Section 8 won't give you more money.
He just signed the lease over in September. My rent went from $650 to $950. What more do you want?
Mm-hmm. Catherine, do they adjust the rents that HUD pays?
They try to adjust
for communities. But is the average rent they'll pay in Cambridge, which is a high rent area, of course, is that different from the average rent they'll pay in the Pocatello?
They only pay 40th percentile. So
but it's
average,
in the community, 40th percentile.
It's in the community.
Okay.
Each community does, they call it a fair market rent. They determine in each community, all across the country. They only pay to the 40th percentile of that. So they don't even pay what the average rent is. So say the average rent is $600, they only pay 40% of that. So right off the bat, you're setting people up for failures. And we know in this country that the vacancy rate in certain communities is just horribly low. And, you know, this is a capitalist society. It's demand and market prices. And unfortunately, the people on the bottom, those disabled, those people who cannot afford to live without help from the federal government because their incomes are low. And many of these people are working people. They're earning $6, $8 an hour, maybe $9 an hour, living in a community where the average rent is $700 a month for two bedrooms or higher. I don't know what it is in Cambridge. It's probably like $1,500. I don't know. But I know in Providence it's around $700. And people say, oh, well, that's low. But try to pay that on minimum wage, or if you're earning $400 a month and you have two kids. I mean, it just doesn't work. And I think, you know, the government is setting people up for failure, in my eyes. And it has to go back to them. They have to do something. Their expectations are unrealistic. People just can't find housing.
Okay, Jeff from Boston, welcome to the Homelessness Marathon.
I am not a homeless person.
Okay.
I am disabled. I am working. I'm receiving Social Security, you know, doing the best that I can. I come into contact with homeless people. They like to hang around at the ATM machines, which I find rather frightening. I have also had the unpleasant experience of having to put homeless people out from the lobby of my apartment building. It's been my policy and the policy of the banks that watch these ATM machines to always offer homeless people a ride to Pine Street Inn. Boston has very good homeless shelters. However, the homeless people don't want to take the ride to Pine Street Inn because Pine Street Inn has rules and enforces some sort of discipline, and they don't seem to like that. My question for your guests, if you're not doing well enough to support yourself, do you think the people like who run Pine Street Inn, who provide for you, have the right to impose some sort of discipline on you if you're not able to do it for yourselves?
Okay, my panel, Missy, Chase, you want to answer that question?
I definitely think there should be and rules for everyone. I mean, that's how you have, you know, you can keep a bunch of people in a house, is you have to have rules. But I believe that a lot of people have, you know, different situations. Maybe some people are, I don't know, anger management. I don't know. There's a lot of where people may have a bad day. And I mean, I was at a place, Rosie's, and the reason why I was kicked out is because I was new to Boston, new to homeless shelters, and I took the wrong bus and didn't get there at the curfew, which was 9 o'clock. So I was kicked out that night and didn't have a bed that night, you know, and I had no idea where I was, and found the homeless youth, took me in very, you know, happily, and just were very kind to me, and found me a place to sleep, and, you know, a blanket to sleep with.
Are you saying, Missy, that the rules are unfair, or are you saying that they are fair, but sometimes you just can't meet the rules?
Yeah, sometimes you just can't meet the rules.
Okay.
You have to have rules, but sometimes you just can't meet them.
Jeff, are you saying that you think all homeless people are undeserving and none of them are good people, or are you saying that there are some elements among the homeless that you don't like?
I don't think that all homeless people can be grouped together. I do think that there are some homeless people who are in that situation through no fault of their own. Perhaps they have mental illness or other unfortunate circumstances. But I think there are also homeless people for whom I have no sympathy whatsoever. And I think the only way they're going to get a free meal and a free bed is if they agree that they have to get up in the morning, get dressed, and be prepared to do a day's work, whether or not there's a job available. And I wouldn't have any problem having rules for people. If you don't want to have the rules, then you have to be the kind of person who can earn your own living and pay your own way. Then you get to make your own rules.
Well, let me ask you one thing, Jeff, and then I'm going to have to let you go. But let me ask you this. You know, we didn't used to have a problem with homelessness in this country. Do you think the number of undesirables, whatever you call them, people you have no sympathy for, people who lead bad lives, do you think the number of those people all of a sudden went up in our society, so that now the undesirables, so to speak, are not housed? How do you account for the fact that we used to have undesirables before, but they had houses?
I don't have a good answer for you. If memory serves me correctly, quite a number of presidential elections ago, the challenger didn't have much of a platform and decided to make homelessness an issue. That was the first time that I can remember that bums became homeless people. That's when the name sort of changed. I think it's been in the news ever since.
Well, Jeff, just historically, that's not true. There were always some people on skid rows, alcoholics and whatnot, but they had housing. In New York, I grew up in Manhattan, they had flop houses. Those houses were torn down. That cheap housing, their single-room occupancy, was torn down to make way for financial institutions and expensive apartments. The housing stock has not been replaced. And historically, while we always had what you call bums, we never had a phenomenon like this before the 80s, just except during the Great Depression, and never during prosperity like this. So anyway, Jeff, I want to thank you very much for your call, and thank you for participating in the Homelessness Marathon.
Thank you.
I'm a Section 8 recipient.
Yep.
In Pasco County, Florida.
Okay.
And before I was on Section 8, I did struggle. I lived in what you could call dumps, and I made a mediocre wage until I decided to go back to school. And it took about a year before I could get on Section 8. And I just wanted to say that here in Florida, Section 8 isn't really all that bad. I live in a very nice apartment, and the the rent. I don't know how much Section 8 pays for my rent, but the landlord is happy with it because he's guaranteed money every month and he doesn't have to keep evicting people, and he knows that I'm not going to wreck his apartment. But then on the other hand, I know other women who are on Section 8 who do drugs in their house. They have men that come over and live with them, and totally bumps out the total Section 8. You know, for people like me, it ruins it for people like me. And I just wanted you to know that here in Florida, as far as I'm concerned, Section 8 has done me a world of good, and I'm so happy that I'm more than grateful for what they have done for me and my daughter.
Well, first of all, Jackie, yippee and congratulations, and good for you and good for Section 8. I don't think anybody has ever said that Section 8 doesn't work for a single person, and I'm very glad that it works for you. If you lost your housing that you have now, which I would not wish upon you, of course, do you feel with your Section 8 voucher you'd be able to find suitable replacement housing in the area you live in?
It would take me, some people give up. They just, you know, take the first house that comes along that'll take Section 8 voucher. But I look through the newspaper, and I talk with the landlord, and I let them know my situation. And when they realize that I'm not going to, you know, trash their apartment and et cetera, et cetera, yes, I can. It is possible to live in a nice another place. This is the second place I've lived in. Had to move because of school and whatnot, but as long as you look and you have a good relationship with the landlord, and you know, you don't have to live on Skid Row when you're on Section 8. And a lot of people think you do. They think, oh, HUD, I'm going to have to go live in the project. That's not true. And
now, so, of course, this may be a regional variation, though, Jackie, because in fact, there's a shortage of housing stock in the Boston-Cambridge area and other areas, Santa Cruz, I know people are listening in and so forth. So there are areas where there simply is no housing, and there's some areas where there is. And so it may be a regional thing, but I'm glad that the Section 8 program is working for you.
Well, also, I think...
Are you still there?
Yeah. Hello? Yes.
Yes, go ahead.
I also...
Do you have anything?
I'm sorry. I just wanted to say also that... I think the cost of living in Florida is a lot cheaper, and that might have something to do with it.
Actually, at the very lowest level of the labor force, you know, people who are working at places like Walmart and McDonald's, wages have risen faster than for any other group over the last 2 years. But the problem is that in most urban areas, housing costs have been rising faster. So it doesn't seem that no matter how fast wages rise for the bottom groups, they don't seem to be able to keep up with housing costs, particularly the cost of rental housing, which is in extremely short supply.
Yes, we wanted to know why aren't there better options for single women that are homeless pertaining to medical problems, drug problems, health problems. The women here get sick every day. It hurts them to be able to have to come and sit in a drop-in center all day long, and people walk past them like they're nothing, and that's wrong. The majority of us that are homeless, we need somewhere where we can go and not only feel safe, but not be treated as abusive, you know, women that are nothing now. We need somewhere where we can go and tell our story to people and find some kind of help or make amends to what is going on in our life so we can... An alcoholic, in order to stop that person from drinking, you have to get to the root of the problem, because if you don't, they will continue to drink.
Tony, I don't know what they call it in Chicago, but they must have some social service department in the city government. Isn't that the place you're supposed to be able to go and get help with your problems?
No, you know, and they do, but it's hard. We don't have the transportation. We don't have people that will stand up exactly for us. We come in the drop-in center We can't leave our bags. We have to take them with us. It's frustrating trying to get a job where you're not dressed right or you smell, you know, and that's wrong. We're just as good as anybody else. All we're asking for is just some kind of support. You know, food is fine, clothes is fine. We need our mental health. If we don't feel good about ourselves, then we won't succeed in what we need to do.
Mm-hmm. How did you become homeless, Clint?
How did I become homeless? I went to Virginia to spend the time with my grandchildren and my daughter. And when I came back, it's hard for me to apply myself money-wise to get me a place of my own. It's just me by myself, but it's hard for me to find a place. They promise you they'll get in touch with you, but they don't. I've been trying to get in senior housing, Chicago Housing Authority. I used to live in Chicago Housing Authority. I have a good record there, but I don't seem to be able to find anything.
Gladys, let me ask you a question that a lot of people want to know. I mean,
yes.
A lot of people will be curious about
this. I don't have a problem with that.
Why can't you? Thank you. If you have a daughter, or a son, and you have children, grandchildren, why can't you stay with your children?
I was living with them. My daughter can't afford to keep me going, you know, and then I'm in another state. You know, that's impossible. And then at my age, I'm 73 years old. I don't really want to live with my daughter and her children. I want my own place by myself. I don't think there's anything wrong with that.
So we are doing something here about ours. And matter of fact, we just had a moratorium put on lofts here that, you know, privatization has been one of the big things going on here, that big companies come in and they just had them carte blank. They're able to go out and build these lofts and run the prices of rent up here and a whole lot of evictions. And, you know, it used to be just mainly African-Americans was being run out. But this time it hit Molden Reese. You know, we got some classism going on here where the rich is just taking over San Francisco and the middle class can't even live here. You don't make $100,000 a year. You know, it makes no difference what color you are. You're in danger of being pushed out of San Francisco.
And at the microphone, what's your name?
Renee St. Lawrence.
Renee, welcome to the Homelessness Marathon. What's on your mind?
Okay, well, I just wanted to tell all the callers my point of view and what I've experienced. As an individual being homeless, I'm 25 years old. This is the first time I've become homeless. It's been 6 months since I've been homeless. I've stayed in various shelters. And what I want to say, too, is that, you know, it's easy for people to basically say, you know, get a job, you know, get yourself out of that predicament, you know, where you are in a shelter. But what I want to say is that for me, when you come from a stabilized environment, a home, apartment, etc., you know, it's not so easy because you're in shock for quite some time. I have been in shock for about 6 months. And I will honestly say that all I've basically wanted to do was to sleep and eat. I've been in deep depression. I know that there are, you know, places like the Boston Housing Authority where I can go and I can fill out an application. And that will come, you know, that's something that I will do. But, you know, for some people, you know, they don't do that automatically. Because of the shock.
And the homeless that I suffered was sleeping from pillar to post, and that was going to my sister's house, my mother's house, my brother's house. You know, that's a form of homeless. And there's a whole lot of families, a whole lot of single adults who are sleeping on their friends' floors you know, night after night after night. You understand me? Robbing Peter to pay Paul. You know, just to survive, to keep from being on the street, or just keep from dealing with the abuse, living in a shelter, and having, if you don't make the lottery, if you didn't make that, if you didn't get a bed that night, all the things you have to do, and then you got to fight and, you know, and fuss over little squat spots and stuff like that, and there, the squatting, it's crazy.
All I can think of when I think of the word homeless, personally, is sitting on the homeless bench waiting for the shelter to open. And that's the most lonely, desolate feeling that I've ever felt in my life. But my reason for pointing out that I was homeless twice is I'd like to mention something about the change in the system. The first time I was homeless was about 7 years ago. And in those days, you could go into a shelter, and if you played nice with the other kids, you could go into a transitional housing, such as the Y. And then in, maybe 6 months, you got your housing. Now, my second time around, it was a whole different ballgame, because there are so many more people and so little affordable housing that it took a year. And after being out of homelessness, it takes, I'd say, anywhere from 2 to 5 years to recuperate from the physical and psychological damage done by being homeless.
Barbara, what was the time span between your first stint of homelessness and your second?
I'd say about 3.5 to 4 years.
And you saw a big change just in that amount of time?
Yeah.
One of the worst things about being homeless, I guess, is the fact that you lose communication with a lot of friends and people, because in my time there was not really something like the organizations that we have today. So I think that's, a lot of people have to realize that once you lose your house, you lose everything that goes along with it, and that's your telephone, and if you're not making good money, you can't afford to sell your phone, you know. So we have 100 voicemail boxes here for people now. So we've learned that really helps. Those voicemail boxes really helps in getting people their services and other places.
Why don't you explain what that means? What does that consist of, the voicemail boxes?
The voicemail is a place where people can disguise their homelessness. Almost like they have an answer machine. They can say, well, I'm not home right now. Please leave a message. So if you go out to look for a job, and you're afraid that you're going to be discriminated because you're homeless, right? You can say, well, this is where I live, 1151 Mass Avenue, and this is my phone number. And it kind of disguises the homeless, and the person can get their message, the phone numbers, the right people they need to get in contact with for jobs, housing, medical, and a lot of other stuff that they need in everyday life. Most people take for granted.
What's it like to be 58 and homeless?
Just speaking for myself, what it's sometimes like is you feel like life's not anywhere near over, but it's just very hard to start over in your 50s. And when you're working day labor 3-4 days a week and staying in a homeless shelter, you're starting over practically from scratch. I'm sure it's worse. I mean, I know it's worse in some other country somewhere. But in terms of American society, you're starting practically from scratch. And sometimes you don't think that you can do it, that you got nothing left. You wonder, you get down on yourself. How did I get in this situation? I myself have a lot of formal education, which makes it even easier to get down on myself in terms of how did I get in this situation where I'm living in a double bunk at the shelter 39 Boylston Street. And sometimes you really have to fight hard to get past that kind of feeling.
Well, what would you say to people who say, look, if you've got a drug problem, you deserve it anyway, and it's your problem, and deal with it?
Well, I'd say to them that, number one, I didn't really start having troubles with homelessness until I got arrested a succession of times for possession of drugs. Now, I feel that I was criminalized, and I actually, you know, I went to prison, and what it did was it made me unemployable in many fields that I used to work in. I feel that I was criminalized unfairly, because just as there are many functioning alcoholics, you know, I was a functioning addict at the time, and I didn't become dysfunctional until repeated, you know, until repeated incarcerations and blows to myself, and then I just lost it.
But just a minute, you're saying your disability income, mm-hmm. you're a genuinely disabled person, even though recently you've just gone back into remission, thank God.
Yeah.
And that does not cover housing. In other words, getting payments as a truly needy person, a disabled person in America, does not give you enough money to get housing?
Not without Section 8, and I've been trying to get a Section 8 apartment for 6 months and haven't been lucky so far.
Mm-hmm.
I hope to get out of the shelter and into a Section 8 apartment, but there's up to a year and a half waiting list, and there is no loopholes because I have multiple sclerosis, and because I might be in a wheelchair. I was in a wheelchair until a month ago.
The day shelters do not coerce with the times of the evening shelters. You have an hour in between where you're standing outside in the cold. You're watching the staff of the day shelters come in with coffee, drinking coffee in the hallways. And you're watching them, and it's snowing out or raining out, and you can't get in because they're so anal about the times that you're supposed to enter into the doors. They won't bend the rule, and I think that that's completely ridiculous.
The thing to know is that the federal housing budget, which supports the programs that provide housing subsidies for extremely low-income people, is really a fraction of what it was in the mid-70s, which was at its high point. It was about 2.5 times higher at that point than it is now. And what's happened is that we have, over time, there's been an erosion to the federal housing budget in terms of the amount of money spent, but there also has been a fairly severe failure to meet the original goals that were set for the housing program. And our sense is that if we had continued with the kind of budget projections and the program goals that were there in the mid-70s, that we would have certainly averted homelessness as we experienced in the 80s and the 90s in the United States.
We talked about the fact that probably there are more services in this area than there are in any other state in the country. The difficulty is that there's not enough affordable housing. And the bottom line is that it doesn't matter how many services there are. It doesn't matter how sober you get. It doesn't matter how much you work towards having a stable mental health. Your own personal mental health is stabilized. It doesn't matter how well you fix your economic issues. If you can't afford a place to live, you're still homeless. And right now, here in Boston and Cambridge, you have to make an income of at least $15 an hour just to afford a shared apartment with three or four other people.
I'm formerly homeless, actually.
Okay.
I just wanted to give a message to everybody out there who happens to be homeless.
Mm-hmm.
I just want to say that there is hope. And not to give up, and that you are a child of God, and you deserve everything that you see everybody else around you having. And I really believe that's important. Because
let me ask you this. Mike, let me ask you something real quick, and then I want to turn this. Maybe my panel would like to ask you some questions as well. Everybody can't have everything they see. If everybody had a Cadillac,
they can't, but
you know, then we'd be draining the whole third world worse than we are.
No, you can't have everything that you want, but a person must first have self-esteem. A person must first know that he deserves the good things in life. Because when I was homeless, you know, I was very depressed. I was, I had no light in my life.
In Boston alone, you must know this figure roughly. How many people who request shelter don't get it?
The answer is a little more complicated. As Vicki mentioned earlier, we really have two systems. There's an individual shelter. So if I was a homeless person alone, I could walk to Pine Street or the Long Island shelter or Shattuck shelter. If they had a bed, I'm in. No questions asked other than my name. If I am the same person and I've got a child with me, I need to go through the state's welfare department. Only Monday through Friday, only 9 to 5. I will not get very good treatment, and that's nothing against the transitional assistance workers, because they're grossly underpaid and they're also put in a difficult spot. But many families are denied shelter. So I'd say for individuals, most can get into shelter, although many on a night like this when it's cold and crowded are only going to be in a lobby and they're going to be on a bench. But families, I'd say a good 25% are just turned away flat.
It's sort of the devil you know is better than the devil you don't know. And if the choice is going back and getting the crap beat out of you or living on the streets with your kids, very often women will go back into that situation because at least they have some sense of control.
So you're saying, let me get this straight. You are telling me and you are telling America that there are actually women, and not a few, who find conditions as a homeless person so bad that they would rather go back to someone who
bad is them. True. That is true.
Do you see homeless women as being in a different situation than you were in when you were homeless as a man, or now?
I think that generally, as women are more vulnerable when they're homeless, just like youth are vulnerable when they are homeless. You know, it's because most women, a lot of women, I'll say not most women, but a lot of women I know from the homeless community, what they do is they latch on to a protector, whether that protector be male or female. You know, there's some pretty tough women out there, too.
Are women who are on the streets, women who are homeless, angry? Are they angrier than men or not as angry as men? Or is anger not really a word that applies?
Well, certainly it's a word that applies, but I think it's for a woman to express it can sort of jeopardize her situation. For example, I was living with people that I certainly felt a lot of rage and anger at, and if I expressed it, I was often the person that might get arrested. And it was, like, totally inappropriate and improper for me to express it in that manner. So while I could be beaten, and if it was his place, it was okay, but if I retaliated and fought back, I would be arrested and put in and maybe jailed. So that, I've had the experience, too. But I think there is a lot of rage, but there's a lot of numbness. I mean, in order to get through these 11 years, I mean, part of me had to go inside, just disappear somewhere. I think there's a lot of unexpressed rage in women. And it manifests itself in ways, in behaviors. Certainly women that are, you know, involved in survival sex or, you know, are shutting off a part of themselves and not dealing with it. And, you know, coming out of that and reintegrating yourself into the mainstream or society, you've got to go through a lot of layers.
What about the reservations? Are the reservations not in good shape? What is the problem with housing on the reservations?
The problem is that there's not housing on the reservation. Of the 2 million Native people living on our country's reservations, 300,000 are homeless. That should give you some kind of idea of what's going on in the reservations. The overcrowding of existing homes. You'll have two, three, sometimes four families living in the same, usually smaller than 1,000-square-foot HUD rental unit. The homes you see on reservations are typically not home ownership. They're HUD rental units. You know, we as a country, we made all sorts of promises with treaty obligations to Native people, and you know, none of it's come through. Rarely as a country and especially as citizens, do we require that our government uphold treaties with Native people?
Homeless people themselves are looked at as, you know, criminals and, you know, drug addicts and whatever. And, you know, I would say the whole population in general has problems with drugs and crime and whatever. And I think, you know, the homeless population is looked at under a microscope.
Let me tell you that, you know, it's a point I make often, and I'm glad you bring this up. How many times have we heard about Robert Downey Jr. being in drug rehab? How many times about Daryl Strawberry? Daryl Strawberry, I've been reading letters about, I'm tired of this guy, I'm tired of giving him other chances. But the fact is, as many chances as these guys have had, and God bless them, and I hope they make it, you never hear about them being homeless.
Right.
They can be, they're drug users, they're never homeless. It's homelessness and drug use do not... It's not an ironclad association, to put it mildly.
Right, and I think people have to realize that the number one homeless population in Rhode Island are children under the age of 5. And you don't see children under the age of 5 out there on the street corner sucking on the crack pipe. It just isn't happening.
Ah, they're all mentally ill drug addicts. What are you talking about, those 5-year-olds? They got to watch them. Now, you know, a question, because you know other homeless kids your age?
I have a whole group I hang out with.
Now, I've asked this question in other marathons. Let me ask it of you. What is the spirit? Do the homeless kids watch out for each other, or are they competing with each other? Are they nice to each other, or are they cutting each other's throats?
There's certain groups. Like, yeah, we all look out for each other. Mm-hmm. We do look out for each other. We're all here for each other. And if one of us, say I have a dollar and a friend needs it, I'll give him my last dollar.
Because
if I have a full stomach and he doesn't, you know what I'm saying? I want to make sure that he's okay.
Mm-hmm.
And most of my friends will do that for me, too.
Tom, you've talked about the universities creating homelessness. Now, it's well known that Harvard and MIT do have some outreach and they do provide some services. Some people think they're good guys. You don't. What do you see happening?
I think what they do is a total Band-Aid on cancer. I spent 12 years living about a mile from both Harvard and MIT, sandwiched between them. It was a neighborhood of triple-deckers where the rent was affordable, partly because of rent control. Harvard and MIT decided they wanted more property for their affiliates. MIT had a huge development complex that's now there called University Park. In 1987, a bunch of us spent 33 days on the spot squatting and refusing to leave because they were tearing down all the triple-deckers. MIT has driven the rents up here considerably, as have Harvard, and every little penny that they give to homeless shelters are just a peanut compared to what they have stolen from this community. They need to be held accountable, despite the fact that they're nonprofits, for all the property that they have gobbled up. Their interest is not the interest of the people here. The tenants, unions, and homeless people have had to fight them all the way for 30 years. And what they're doing now is pure public relations. It's not replacing the affordable housing that they've taken away. And I hold them accountable, and I hope the public will do so as well.
I'm from Portland, Oregon, and I do want to say that this is the most real radio show I've ever heard. I mean, I have...
Oh, thank you.
Couldn't go to sleep because I had to listen.
They talk about, with hunger, individuals, they talk about 2.9, roughly 3% of the population, which is something like close to 8 million people. If you look at those who are food insecure, which is, as I said, much larger, you know, you can talk about maybe 10, 11, 12% of the population.
What is the trend as far as hunger goes, however you define it? Are more people hungry in the last decade or fewer people hungry? Is it going up or down?
Well, I think the situation is pretty much like we're seeing across the board in terms of other indicators that I know you've been talking about tonight and in other times, that it's definitely getting worse, and that's particularly surprising in times of what we keep calling or hearing about this great economic boom that we've been living in. What we've been seeing, and this is a nationwide trend, is more and more people eating in soup kitchens, food pantries, community kitchens, whatever you want to call those sites. We know, for example, that somewhere between roughly 40% of people who are eating in many of these emergency food sites
are employed and have jobs and are working. Another 40% is our children, so you can't expect them to be working. So this idea of the bum on the street who's just begging for food is really, really inaccurate, and unfortunately it continues to get portrayed, but it's not really, you know, a large percentage of the population that's out there in need.
I got into this, you know, scary situation while I was living in my car, and my car didn't even have, you know, up-to-date tags on it. And before long, you know, it was like a kind of downward spiral into homelessness. And another thing I wanted to mention was that, you know, for quite a while I had a job during this period until things started getting rougher, and I found that even though I had a job, if you don't have a place to go home to after, you know, after you've done work, if you have to go out and sleep in your car, there's a cumulative fatigue factor that sets in where you don't really get rest when you're sleeping in a car, especially if it's cold. And I found that here I was, you know, didn't think it could happen to me. found out I was homeless and getting depressed, and like Jay was talking about a few minutes ago, you know, the humiliation and frustration and mental downward spiral that takes place when you find yourself caught up in this this vicious cycle. And you know, people should realize there's a lot of talent being wasted. There's a lot of good people out there that aren't lazy, just got caught up in this kind of circumstance and really couldn't find a way out of it. It has this way of pulling you down.
So in this particular, our particular department has been providing services to queer homeless youth, if you will, for close to 19 years now. And current numbers show that there's upwards of 6,000 youth on the street in Hollywood that self-identify as gay, lesbian, bisexual, and or transgender. So a very large population, most likely the majority of the homeless youth that are on the street in Hollywood tend to be gay or lesbian or bisexual or transgender.
Searching for flowers of hope within the snow and ice of a cold, indifferent, and hostile world. Growing impatient for life's endless winter to pass, since spring's warmth may not be enough to compel these expectant blossoms to rise and flower. Like so many others mindlessly trampled, leaving the world barren, desolate of those whose faith, beauty, passion, strength, and resolve would usually still be able to rise had they not had this spirit carelessly plucked from them.
Now I'm on Social Security, which I got at 62, and I'm 64 now, and they just reduced my food stamps from $86 to $66 because I got a $12 cost of living increase.
Right now, I'm going to recognize someone at the microphone outside the Tabernacle of Truth here on the streets of Cambridge, Massachusetts. What's your name?
Hello, my name is Susan Baroni.
Susan, welcome to the Homelessness Marathon.
Hi. It's a good thing you're doing.
It's a cold morning here in Harvard Square. Do you live around here?
I stay around here sometimes. I'm homeless.
Mm-hmm. How long have you been homeless?
Since March 99.
Uh-huh. And can you talk a little bit about how you became homeless?
Well, basically I became homeless. I was like using the majority of my paycheck to pay for an apartment in Revere, $400 a month. Mm-hmm. And I went away over the Christmas vacation and I got robbed of the money I'd saved up for that month to pay. And it was an illegal apartment. Because the landlord, I went to Salvation Army to get the money I needed, and he rented it out from under me. Mm. And I really didn't know about fighting for it or anything. And so I put my stuff in a storage locker, and I've been maintaining the storage locker, and I've been homeless since then.
I think a lot of people across the country don't know necessarily, but $400 a month for an apartment is pretty unusual in the Boston area. You're more likely to pay twice that.
I know, and I thought, well, it'd be possible to find something else, you know, in that range. But it seems from the time that I lived in Pine Street from March until August.
Pine Street is a shelter, correct?
Yes, and it burnt me out on shelters. I mean,
how come?
Because it felt like a prison more than a shelter. Everything had to be lined up. The priorities was always given to people who had substance abuse problems over people that supposedly were doing all right for themselves.
Well, I'd just like to say that, you know, Pine Street Inn has a wonderful reputation in the area, and I think, in my personal opinion, it's one of the best ones there is, but that doesn't mean it's a livable situation for a lot of
people. The problem with it is that it's just too big. And unless that you actively seem to be having a lot of problems, you just it's another way that you just fall through the cracks, you know.
Yeah, they don't have enough people and enough resources.
Right. I mean, I had an advocate there, but she was only there 3 days a week. And when I came up for housing, I couldn't even get a referral letter from them because she wasn't there on the days I came in.
Susan, what do you do for money?
I work here at Bread and Jam, so I work 20 hours a week here. I clear 620 a month. I have scoliosis, so I've been trying to work. Hopefully sometime I'll be able to, you know, work myself into a full-time job and everything, but I'm trying, you know.
Do you have any prospects for an apartment? Are you working on Section 8 housing or anything like that?
I'm working on it, but most of the waiting lists at, you know, 2 or 3 years, you know. So
you go down to the whoever it is, I don't know what they call it here, but the social services department by whatever name, and they just tell you they have no solution for you?
Yeah. That's more or less it. And because I'm working, I don't get really all that much time that I can go to places. You know, but I do what I can. I put my name in a lot of places. I'm going to be putting my name in another one that's opened up, the Malden one. And, you know, I just keep doing it, and hopefully, you know, that, you know, it's done by lottery. So unless you get one of the high numbers, you know, it's a long wait, you know. But, you know, and if, you know, for some reason I'm thinking maybe somewhere down the road I can maybe try to rent a room or something. But, you know, that's kind of the way it is. Is that there's so many little things that people that haven't been homeless don't realize about. Like, if you don't get into a shelter at night, it's not even places you can go to the bathroom. You know, because most of the places you got to be a patron, so that's either spending a lot of money going in a place, or else, I don't know, trying to find a place you can go outside. It's a lot of little things. It's almost an art to learn how to live out here.
I think somebody was saying earlier tonight, or last night, I guess at this point, that, you become a different person, and then you have to get off it afterwards. You actually have to detoxify and go into withdrawal. I forget how they said it. They said it much better than I did.
You have to withdraw from being homeless, in a sense.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And it's just, I can see why a lot of people, I think, get into the situation that they are, and they become almost institutionalized because they've lost hope, you know, and it's very easy to do, you know.
Do you still have hope, Susan?
Oh, yeah.
Are there countries where you have a right to a house?
Yes. If we look at some of the places in Europe, even, you know, when I traveled to Gaza, even though it's an incredibly poor area of the world, there was no homeless people in Gaza. A lot of poverty, but people not living on the streets.
And to what do you attribute that?
I think the growing up and the fostering in a community that it's not okay to allow, you know, women and children or just human beings to have to sleep outside, that they're not expendable. human beings, and that they should be provided for and taken care of, and that we have a responsibility to each other as brothers and sisters and human beings.
You know, it's really quite staggering, Sherry, because Gaza is held up as the as a terrible example of man's inhumanity to man, and God knows there are problems in the Middle East that need to be solved. But you're actually saying on this program that the people in Gaza are living in better conditions, despite everything, than people in the major cities in America.
Absolutely. I sat in a human rights office in Gaza, and we shared stories, and some of the organizers there just couldn't believe that we live in such a rich country, and yet we allow people to sleep outside. They just couldn't even deal with that.
There's not any city that has any kind of model policies, and even cities that might have laws that look good on the books sometimes don't implement them in a good way. Like in New York State, in New York City, there is some right to shelter. But the way that the city has interpreted that is that they, when families come to apply for shelter, they have them sleep overnight on the floor of one of the welfare offices.
You know, the problems that we run into are basically the same problems that any doctor runs into, I think, taking care of any population. I think what we what we've had to learn in caring for homeless people is that when you have no safe place to recover and no place to call a stable home, the problems are difficult, much more difficult to handle, and your struggle to find your next meal or your next house means that you often delay taking care of those problems.
Jim, you have this group, Healthcare for the Homeless. And yet the part that I don't understand, or that I wish you would clarify for people who are listening, is this. We're told that no one goes without health care. They can go to an emergency room. Everybody has access to health care. So by that reasoning, why would you need a group, Healthcare for the Homeless?
Good question, nobody. The real reason that we think we had to exist was because homeless people themselves back in 1985 got together and sort of identified their problem as, of course, they had access to emergency rooms, but when they went there, they waited for hours. They always saw a different physician. And because of the circumstances that they were fighting every day, it was very hard to go and wait 8 hours in an emergency room. So their real request for us, and I think the challenge that faces all healthcare workers who want to sort of address the obstacles homeless people face, is that you have to get out of the hospitals and into the places where people are and feel comfortable. And give you an example, we used to have a clinic down at the hospital we were very proud of that we opened up and wanted to have it especially for anyone who was homeless. You could come in without an appointment. And we did this down in the old Boston City Hospital. It was in the afternoon. We found that almost nobody came. And of course, when we went out to the shelters, we realized that if you're trying to get your bed in the shelter, you have to be in line by about 2 o'clock in the afternoon to start waiting for the shelter doors to open. And then once you get inside, you had to wait in another line to get your meal ticket, which was the next most important thing for the night. And it was only after that that people would then start to say, maybe I'll think about my health care problems. But by then, of course, the only place you could go was an emergency room that was full of a lot of trauma. So I think what we learned from the shelter providers, particularly from the nurses who were working in shelters at the time, is that we had to get the doctors and nurse practitioners out to the shelters where at the times when people were felt comfortable and could address those issues.
I have been continually employed for the past 22 years. I am a husband and a father. I support my wife and two children. I believe that the homelessness problem in America is contrived, that it is advantageous to government and industry, which have essentially been the same entity for my entire life, like the idea that there are as many visible homeless families as possible, because it keeps the working poor, such as myself, very frightened, and we do not speak out.
The first thing that I've seen about my struggles being homeless is the kids. It's a terrible place to see the kids' face and see them hurting and see the pain that's in their faces. And I've seen kids, you know, just go and just being crying, you know, in the bathrooms and stuff in these homeless shelters. And so we have to stop, you know, we have to stop the kids from being homeless. You know, the old folks, I'm a veteran. I can survive through anything. But, you know, I can't stand to see the kids, you know, struggle and hurt and be in pain. And that's the thing that, and they have no guidance whatsoever. No counselors, you know, in some program like Pine, but throughout the shelter and system, don't help them get through and show them what to do and show them how to get a job and that sort of thing.
One of the major issues right now is that because the cost of housing is so high all across the country, the actual wage you would need to be able to afford a two-bedroom apartment anywhere in the United States is about $12.47 an hour. And in the meantime, the minimum wage is $5.15 an hour, and we've been unable to increase that for the last 3 years. So it's really critical that we deal with one or the other, that we at minimally provide greater housing assistance to folks, or we increase their incomes to the point where they are actually able to afford housing. One of the realities of who has become homeless in more recent times is a larger and larger number of people who are employed but whose incomes are not high enough to be able to afford housing. It just doesn't make any sense. It's not logical. It's not something that I think most middle Americans would agree should be. I mean, I think people really do say if you are working hard and doing your part, there's no question that you should be able to afford housing. And for folks who really are not able, because of disability or elder age, to be able to, or some other condition, are not able to work and therefore sustain themselves, we really do have an obligation as members of the same community to ensure that they have housing stability and that they have enough food and that they should never have to become homeless and should never have to get their food out of a dumpster. It's just outrageous that in this country, of all the countries in the world, we can't do a better job of this.
Yes, good morning. My name is Hans Jensen, and I'm calling to say that I'm a long-term resident of the city of Cambridge, and I'm a city worker. I'm a public servant, and I find it's a shame that someone who works for the city cannot afford to live in the city that he or she works for. And I've been told to move to Medford, move out of state. It's a shame. I can't believe it that someone who works for a city cannot afford to live in the area where he wants to live.
We really do have to help people understand that this is not acceptable. I think as Americans we've become much too complacent and have not advocated and said to folks that basically have the money that we've given them that it has to be spent to provide housing for folks that live in the communities in which they work.
I agree, and I think that rent control needs to be brought back. We lost rent control Cambridge in 1994, and since then the rents have quadrupled and no repairs have done. I'm paying close to $1,800 a month, and I never get any repairs done.
Oh, my Lord.
I see rats running in the yard. It's horrible.